and welcome. This is another episode of The Thing About Cars. It is a wintry day here in Atlanta, Georgia. How are you guys doing?
Wintry?
I am cold.
Is it winter?
Yeah, no snow. No, that's true. No snow. I just think it's cold, so I'm complaining. Around the table today, we have Dawn. Are you there?
I am here, and I'm shivering.
And Ben?
Hey, hey.
Dave?
I am here, and I am shivering as well.
And our special guest, Arp?
I'm here as well, Mick.
Excellent. Welcome. And let's start our episode with a grand trivia auto question. In fact, I'm going to just hand the ball over to Ben since he actually already knows the answer to this question. So, Ben, take it away.
Yeah, this one came from our good friend Tim Rogers. Thank you, Tim. This is a good one. Basically, it's having to do with the Lincoln brand of car, these nice big American luxury cars. And, you know, it... Where does the name come from, basically, is the question. The company, of course, was started by Henry Leland, who previously had been the founder of Cadillac. He moved on and did another thing. So two for two for big luxury brands for Mr. Leland. Anyway, so where does the Lincoln name come from? Choice A is that in 1917, Henry Leland chose to name his new car company Lincoln to honor President Abraham Lincoln. B, British immigrant Richard Trevithick founded Lincoln Boiler Company in 1844. In Old English, Lincoln means fresh water. By 1909, Lincoln had completely switched from making industrial steam boilers to complete cars. Or C, Lincoln is the name of the ancient pharaoh's enormous palace in the center of Luxor, Egypt. Investors in Lincoln Motor Company thought the name conveyed wealth and exclusivity appropriate for a luxury car.
All three of them, excellent, excellent choices. So again, those choices are, I'm going to read them backwards, men. Lincoln is the name of the ancient pharaoh's enormous palace in the center of Luxor, Egypt. Investors in Lincoln Motor Company thought the name conveyed wealth and exclusivity appropriate for a luxury car. Choice B was British immigrant Richard Trevithick. Can we just take a minute to appreciate that name, Trevithick? That's just
oh, yeah.
Funny. Yes.
It's great.
He was a railroad pioneer, by the way.
Okay. So British immigrant Richard Trevithick founded Lincoln Boiler Company in 1844. In Old English, Lincoln means fresh water. So by 1909, Lincoln had switched from making industrial steam boilers to complete cars. And then choice A was in 1917, Henry Leland chose to name his new car company Lincoln to honor President Abraham Lincoln. One of those is the right answer. And that takes us to our next segment, which belongs to Dave. Dave's got a cultural collision for us today. What have you got?
Well, I've spent the weekend putting up Christmas decorations because our house is a production at Christmas. And as I was doing it, I glanced at something online and happened to see Christmas Vacation, specifically Cousin Eddie, pull up in his motorhome. So I thought we would actually talk today about motorhomes and the role motorhomes play in American culture. So the starting point, I was like, okay, I poured myself a drink last night and started Googling history of motorhomes. And what's interesting, actually, when the industry itself points to the Conestoga wagon as the origin of the motorhome, because the Conestoga wagon and is what opened up the America West. And
that makes sense. You put all your stuff in there.
You haul it, you live in it. And I had always thought, certainly it was older than that, because I was thinking of images of the Roma in Europe living in like horse-drawn carts. And actually, the Roma didn't move into those kind of carts until like the mid-1800s. But the earliest, what we would consider a motorhome, went to the market in 1910 when the Pierce Arrow Motor Company introduced the Touring Landau at the Madison Square Garden Auto Show. And it was not a motorhome in the way we think of it. It was specialized more like for camping in mind, because it was just full of cargo compartments for your camping equipment, your tents, your stove. There was even an onboard toilet put into the car. Fortunately, no drawings of that survive. And then sometime like in the 1920s, individual builders started, converting panel trucks and buses, specifically with the idea of that, people would tour and camp in these things. And the industry, if you look at some of the early stuff, it really borrows all of this design from the early innovations of aircraft. And during World War II, the whole industry shut down because of the war, and then didn't really start coming back into the 1950s. And that was actually when the term house cars was converted to motorhome. And you began having the creation of all of these motorhomes, including the most famous one, the Winnebago.
Yes. We had many.
I remember you saying this in a show before, and then we had talked about it separately, that your family had a lot of motorhomes, right?
A lot. From the time, time in memoriam, I literally cannot remember when we didn't have a house on wheels. And the stories and all of the movies that lend themselves to the crazy things that have happened in a motorhome has happened to us. My parents traded a plot of land on a lake for their first mini Winnie. We actually went out to Winnebago, and I believe that's headquartered in Wisconsin, to get our Brave. I mean, we've had a Chieftain. We've owned other companies, but Winnebago was the standard that we had from when I was just tiny small. I mean, we could have had this beautiful lake house, but no, we had motorhomes our whole life, or RVs. And just one, I'll tell you a story. One time for the holidays, we went to Arizona, and it was, my dad would always create these road trips, and my dad was a topographer, cartographer. So the maps were everywhere. And we were out at the Grand Canyon, and I was bored, and all the sand kind of got up on the back of, I think we had a Brave at that time. And so I picked up a rock and I started to etch into the sand on the back of the motorhome where you unhook it and you pull it down and all your whole baggage is in the back there. And I thought, because I tried to do my finger, but it was just too, wasn't very detailed. So I was making these nice little intricate scene on the back of the motorhome, and my dad comes back and, oh my God, the rock had etched into the fiberglass, and I had ruined the entire, luckily it was the part that you could literally get replaced. Oh, my father had a fit. The scene where you open up the dump tank and you forget to, hold it so it doesn't release while you're fixing all of your hoses, and it goes in your face. The time that your generator goes out and it's 100 degrees outside. We were in Ohio, and my dad always wanted to go on the road less traveled. And for some reason, the road was not finished. And the motorhome literally was airborne for like 20 seconds. We literally flew off the road and landed like 5-10 feet down. And had to get a tow truck to get us out. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
But it's funny, actually, so interesting, the fact that you're in Ohio, interesting statistic that in the United States, 85% of the recreational vehicles sold are manufactured in Indiana. And roughly 2/3 of the production in Indiana is in one place, Elkhart County, which essentially calls itself the RV capital of the world. Growing up in Ohio, I just remember, there seems to be a lot of advertising for people going to Indiana to go get RVs, specifically Richmond, Indiana.
Well, when we were growing up, we never stayed at a hotel, ever. I didn't stay in a hotel until we moved to Germany. And it was just, my mother loved it. It's literally a dream. You just grab your wallet, load everybody in the motorhome. Everything's there. Everything that you need is there. You can end up anywhere at the end of the day. it's very romantic life. I think it's a wonderful way to travel.
I was going to say, I'd been even more impressed if you told me you took the RV with you to Germany.
Oh, we tried. military pay, we just couldn't pay for the freight. We ended up, now that's a whole nother story. We ended up buying a Dodge panel van with windows in Germany and tented all through Europe. Like we bought tents and sleeping bags and whole outdoor grill systems and tented our way through France and Germany and Switzerland, everywhere. Italy.
It just sounds cool.
Yeah.
You know, the closest thing to that whole experience that my brother and I had was back when we were little kids in the 70s, we had the little Tonka Winnebago, which, you know, was about 2 feet long, all made of pressed steel, had little husband and wife and Cocker Spaniel action figures that went with it.
I
had it too.
You know, Christmas 1 year.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we would sit on the roof of the thing and ride it down our steep driveway and crash at the bottom. And that sucker took so much abuse and it just kept on ticking.
We never had an RV of any kind. Did your family ever do the RV thing?
We never been in one outside of, you know, going to an auto show or something like that. Funny story, however, so I was raised here. My wife, as Mick knows, was raised in India. So she comes over late 90s and sees one of these things for the first time. And so now I'm going to use this opportunity to trademark this name. So I kind of told her a similar story, Dave. And so she coined the name Runawaygo, which is just apropos, right? Because to Don's point, you run away and you go, right? And you can do it immediately. So she has this fascination. So one of the bucket list items for both of us is for us, I don't think we'll ever buy one, but is to rent one and take it across whatever section of the country that we're going to go. And again, you have to understand, both of us, you know, it will not be meager.
Okay,
it'll have to be a certain cut of runaway go that we will have in order to satisfy whatever our pleasures are. So, but very curious that today happened to be the day that you chose this topic, because in our house it's a big thing to finally go on that trip in an RV.
I'll give you some advice. My parents, when my dad was diagnosed with Parkinson's, sold their last RV. It's been about 5 years. So my parents literally, my entire life, like 50 years, had an RV always. And so we rented one last year. And let me tell you, if you want a glamper, which is the more upscale one that you're talking about, be prepared to pay a lot of money. I was shocked how much it cost us for a month in the smallest Mini Winnie I've ever been in, for adults and a dog.
I am familiar. I have done the research. And so, you know, instead of going to Europe, I think we'll go on a trip in a glamour, as you say. So, yeah,
I mean, we went for an entire month. And let me tell you what. We have so many funny pictures. And my sister and I would sit out by the campfire and just go, this is amazing. We love it. This is great. But our heads were shaking back and forth. Like, this is unbelievable that we, the four adults, are literally doing this. And it was a special time, because here's the other thing. My sister and I drove, because my mom and dad can't drive the RVs anymore. And my sister ended up almost driving the whole trip. She wouldn't let me drive. She was so nervous because there's so many blind spots, and there's a lot more technology on them these days. I think it's a lot easier to drive, but it's a little nerve-wracking to think about all those years my dad just jumped in and drove away. And I would sleep in the back, and my sister and I played games, never even gave it a thought until we started driving. Some lessons.
Sorry, Dave, go ahead.
I was just saying, maybe, I was like, never thought of anything laying in the back. When he drove off the road, maybe you should have changed that philosophy.
All right. So here's my devil's advocate statement on this. As much as I truly love the romance of hopping into some sort of RV and driving to wherever you want to go, given as how expensive they are to either own or to rent, am I simply not better off loading up my car and renting hotel rooms wherever I want to go?
No, you're not. No? It's worth every dime.
Because it costs less to drive and maintain that car.
It doesn't matter. It's not about money.
It probably costs a little less to just rent rooms.
This is not a cost-benefit analysis, it's not about my money. Dear. This is a pure out experience that you cannot pay for by without doing this.
Yeah.
There is a culture around it. There's a camaraderie. There's a total romance to it. I'm telling you, you won't know it until you do it.
Right.
Well, I've got to agree with Don. This is not a place where you impose logic, Mickey. If people used logic, no one would ever buy boats either.
That's so true.
Yeah.
Well, I think what we do is car. I mean, we're car enthusiasts. We're travel enthusiasts. I don't think money often comes in, I mean, a lot of us are realistic, but I don't think it comes into play when you do these experiences.
Well, and I think also, it's in terms of money and finances, you also look at, there's different classes of RVs. Different costs and they depreciate. So a lot of times buying one that's a year or two old but not a lot of mileage on it is much more cost efficient. I had to go back and actually, because I've been seeing the terminology for years. And so went back and looked at the three. And I think this is useful to know the difference, because Class A motorhomes are the ones that we've been talking about. These are the most luxurious and expensive ones. It's got a solid body. These are the ones that will have tip outs and a washer and dryer and dishwasher and are super high end.
And then they may even have Corian counters. I mean, yes.
We go to
fireplaces
all the time. Yeah. And I look at these things, that we walk to the one that I'm like, has to weigh more than the city of Topeka, Kansas.
Yeah.
You've got Class B motorhomes, which are called low profile or semi-integrated. These ones are, usually have like a fixed double bed in the back of the vehicle, but there's no overhead bed above the cab of the truck. And then the Class C is known as a coach built. This is where the more built on a truck chassis. And so you've got a bed, put up over the top of the cab. These are the smallest ones. My experience from all my years camping, these are the smallest ones. These are the most expensive ones. And these are the ones most preferred by people who have like seven or eight enormous dogs.
Class A.
We have five Ridgebacks. Let's get the smallest vehicle we can and stuff them in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there is nothing. I wouldn't change our RV experience for all the Holiday Inns in the world. It's so amazing. I mean, literally, I've got chills thinking about it, thinking about the times and the stories that my parents have told, the games that we've played. One time, my grandmother made a big pot of halushki, and I'm ethnic. I'm Slovak, Greek, and French, and Italian, and she made this huge pot, and it is, when you talk about halushki, it's pigs in the blanket and wrapped in sauerkraut, and it's wow. It's a lot of very heavy flavors. Somebody, who knows, forgot to latch the refrigerator, and we took a corner, and the entire refrigerator contents literally spilled out all throughout the cabin, and that halushki was everywhere. I mean, it was crazy. So you're not going to find that at a Holiday Inn. And the look on my grandmother's face, how long it took her to make that dish. And she was swearing in Slovak. Like, I don't think I would ever see her swear. It's priceless.
I think we're about out of time for cultural collision, but it's clear we need to come back and talk some more about the RV experience.
Yes.
We're going to revisit this topic, you know, because we've only just scratched the surface.
We're just scratching the surface.
So, yeah, Arpa, I wish you great travels, and find one and do this trip. It is, you will love it.
We will. This has been an experience, I think, to kind of nudge me in that direction. So thank you.
Arp, you contacted us initially via Facebook saying that you wanted to talk about the Zen of Options. What does that mean?
So the Zen of Options. So actually you had put out, I felt like I was solicited, actually. Like, you know,
we've talked some about sort that.
Of, sorry. Yeah, yeah, you know.
Two-bit strumpet or something. I don't know. It was and so the Zen of Options, you know, I think the request, perhaps my kind of sell, was about rain sensing windshield wipers and ventilated seats. And so we just recently traded out of a Lexus ES350 and got a little NX300H. So there's just it's a smaller version of the RX SUV or crossover. And, you know, got through all the paperwork and this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, it's got the rain sensing wipers, right? Because the 350 had that. And he's like, man, I think you got to pay like $4,000 extra for whatever package it is that gets you the rain sensing wipers. And so I'm thinking, your whole line of questioning, Mick, and everything was, we've lost our focus when it comes to cars, right? So I'm looking at a picture of a bunch of cars in the background on Mickey's Zoom display. And so this whole thing of, you know, we've gotten into the rain sensing wipers and the ventilated seats, and how nice is it just to think about kind of the deep rooted aspect of a vehicle, right? And the engine and the steering but we've gotten so caught up in the Zen and meditating on all these accoutrements, right? That we've forgotten about the car and what the car does for us and where it gets us. And, you know, Don, I think you, so sort of the romantic element of the car, everything is a commodity. How much more have we added? How much more are we going to get out of this? Now, I know there's been a lot of safety features added and, you know, conditioning to make life nice, but we have lost our focus. And look, I'm first one to tell you I've lost my focus, because we're so caught up in this. You know, even yesterday when we were driving back and forth to Auburn to pick up our daughter, I don't have these rain sensing wipers. It's just, and I've become so accustomed to them.
I thought those were your eyes.
Right? Yeah.
And as they drop onto your windshield.
Well, Ben and I have actually talked about this in the past at some point. It was online long before the thing about cars ever existed as a recording. I remember Ben saying things like, you know, none of these things you're talking about have anything to do with the actual element of driving.
Right.
Anyway, please continue.
Yeah, no, I think that the conversation that you and Ben had was a foreshadow of this program, I guess, because, you know, I'd like to go back, and I can remember my first car was my dad's Gold Duster. 1976 Gold Duster, and I had a steering wheel kind of out to here. Obviously, the folks that are listening, yeah, I mean, you could. It was like hugging a 400-pound man or something. It was wonderful. I'm
feeling personally attacked by that comparison.
and then I had my first car that I had was a Cutlass Salon and a Chevy Cutlass Salon, and it was a 350 four barrel, you know, all that stuff. And it had this real kind of meaty engine, but yet it was light blue color. So it had this kind of, you know, daintiness about it, I guess, because of the color. And so, you know, but there's a part of me that misses that, you know, that misses that pureness that, and it had, they had no accoutrements. I think the Cutlass had power windows, was as good as it got. Right. The Gold Duster had nothing. In fact, you had to push a button in the left. Yeah. Crank. Oh, most definitely. You had to push a button in the left top side to turn on the high beams.
Oh, yes. Actually, the floorboard.
Yeah. Do you remember that?
The floorboard, there was a little button in those cars.
There was a little button.
You tapped with your left foot that put the high beams.
Yeah.
My husband and I were looking at a car the other day that had that. And he said, do you know what that is? And I was like, yeah, that's the high beams. He's like, you know that? I'm like, yeah.
My dad's old Plymouth had that.
Yep.
Every car that I ever drove up until the 90s had one of those.
Right. So mine too.
And now it's like you've got this lever and you've got to figure out, and it's got auto, you know, with the lights and high beams and all, again, safety wise, I love the fact that my high beams come on automatically, right? So if there's no one in either direction at night, they come on, you don't have to worry about turning them off. But again, you're almost detached from the vehicle, you know, the pure elements of the vehicle are just no longer.
I will say the only accoutrement or add that I cannot live without now is a cup holder.
A cup holder.
Yes. Holder.
And car companies specifically market cup holders to women more aggressively than they do to men.
Isn't that crazy? But there, I literally could get rid of everything else. I'd be glad to have the button on the floor. I'd be glad to roll up and down my windows, crank them. But that cup holder is just, it's so important. It's crazy. And multiple cup holders, you know.
Arp, have you ever read the actual short story behind the Rush song, Red Barchetta?
I've not.
Ben, you've read it, right? I think you were the one who handed it to me.
Yeah.
And what's that story about? Can you give us a quick synopsis, Ben?
Yeah, it takes place in a future age when cars as we know them today are, you know, not around anymore. Well, not much anyway. And keep in mind, this was written in 1973. It originally ran as a short story in Road and Track. But it takes place in some future age. I forget if the year is specified. And in this future, these cars are all these big, giant, heavy safety mobiles that, you know, can run into a building and nobody will be hurt or something like that. And good old-fashioned cars, as, you know, we know them, are outlawed. And the protagonist has an uncle who lives out in the country where, now, in the original story, it was not a Ferrari. It was an MG. Neil Peart turned it into a Ferrari when he wrote the song. But as the story goes, the uncle has this old MG in a barn out in the country, and the protagonist would go out there on weekends sometimes and drive the thing around. And it became a deadly game because all the big giant safety mobiles would, you know, try to mow him down just for the fun of it.
Because they would experience no damage, no harm. So, you know, they have relative immunity, but they would, you know, try to get the guy in the tin can.
Yeah, I think the story was called A Drive in the Country or something like that.
Right. The idea being is that, you know, all these safety features left people with no responsibility whatsoever.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, and soon we're going to give up driving, right? I mean, we looked at a Tesla before we chose this Lexus. And why even have a car, right? Just have someone else drive. I mean, we have that now, right? But why even, if you're just going to take your hands off the steering wheel and just let the car go, I don't know if that, to me, satisfies some element of going for a drive, right? Because then you're just a spectator in what is clearly not a spectator sport,
right?
Because you're driving the car. You are driving the car.
Yeah,
and so
I get worried about that, Arp. Like, those of us that love to drive and then you have autonomous vehicles, you're going to be maybe the only human being sitting in the driver's seat. And everybody else is going to be just kind of laid back, reading a book, looking at their iPhones or their tablets, and then you're going to be like, what?
right. So what's the upshot of all this, Arp? How do we, you know, to use a pun, how do we steer ourselves away from that, or can we simply not avoid it? It's just the way things are going to be from now on.
I don't think you can avoid it. You know, there's too much ambition and you know, call it fiscal motivation, economic motivation to automate and create this world of, you know, that Mr. Peart wrote so wonderfully about. And I think it's out of our hands. You know, I think the beauty of it is something like this show, right, that just really kind of brings the focus back to RVs and talk about automobiles more than just the mechanical aspect of them, but they're part of our culture. They're part of our lives, you know, and you can look at it not only kind of in the world of vehicles, but in software and artificial intelligence, and where are we going from a from the perspective of our humanness, right?
Yeah.
Is that we're diluting that every
well,
day.
And every I day. Think about the first time I went to buy a car as an adult, and I wanted to talk with the salesperson about what was under the hood. I was very adamant that I wanted a six-cylinder. I was very adamant about certain aspects, you know, a little bit about fuel efficiency, how the car handled, you know, what the, what, how many, you know, gears did it have? And the guy kept trying to talk to me about cup holders and, you know, oh, automatic windows, and there's a moonroof. And, you know, that's the other part that's really hard, even for us as women, is when you do want to talk about what's under the hood, you get, you know, it's like, don't look behind the curtain. Let me show you something over here. And so, yeah, I think that's,
I remember when I decided to change careers and go into marketing and started to learn one of the industries that arguably both has some of the best and the worst marketing tactics are the automotive industry. And remember reading case studies on how within General Motors, I think it was the Pontiac division, was the division that was created to make women cars. That was the cars that were specifically targeted at women. And you know, Chevy was the testosterone driven car. You know, so cup holders premiered in Pontiac models, not in Chevy models. It does speak to, you know, these perceptions. You know, I think what we've alluded to this in the show before is there's a difference between driving as an utilitarian activity versus driving as something that you enjoy. And there, you know, when I was commuting to, you know, 30 miles every day to work, I would have loved to have had a self-driving car. But, you know, truth being is I would just sat there and done email or, you know, written reports instead of enjoying it.
But, well, yeah, you know, not to cut you off, Dave, but I'm wondering if this is all about the productivity of us as humans, and not the enjoyment that we have engaging and interacting with our technology.
Yeah,
just for the record,
hit the nail on the head. Absolutely.
Well, we are a little over time, but I do want to talk at that point. I mean, I wonder if this is a uniquely American thing, or if the rest of the world is sort of adopting the same values. You know, the whole aesthetic of appreciating an experience is something that is interpreted differently in different countries. You know, I'm thinking of Japan as a stark difference. You walk down any average city street in Japan, and just the aesthetic at the way that things are arranged and portrayed is very different than the way we do it here. So are we talking about a cultural phenomenon, or is this universal? And is it simply a matter of aesthetics, or is are we talking about the next steps in human evolution? I know that's a stretch, but forgive me. Yeah.
That's really deep, though.
Very deep.
Thank you for helping us to articulate that. I think that's something we need to talk about more often. Our guests, we always ask our guests a handful of pretty standardized questions. And my questions for you today are, our first three questions are pretty standardized anyway. What is your dream car?
So my dream car is, and I can't tell you exactly which car, but I can tell you the features. And the most prominent feature is it's a four-door convertible.
Okay.
That is my dream car.
Four-door convertible.
So I don't know, maybe I'm smitten with Mikhail Gorbachev or someone else that, you know, had those I don't know who had those types of vehicles, but they're so hard to find. And I guess there's a lot of negative press on them because their structural integrity is so bad, right? And so, but that would be my dream car, would be a four-door convertible.
Ben, does such a thing exist? Have you seen anything like that recently?
Well, nothing like that has been made recently, but it's not a completely foreign concept. Back in the 60s, there was such a version of the Lincoln Continental.
Right.
I'm thinking exactly of the Zapruder film, actually.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Although that was, by the time it gets turned into a presidential car, you can't really put the top up anymore.
Exactly. Right. All right, Art, my second question. I'm sorry, Don.
No, I was thinking of, there was a recent TV show with a bunch of guys who, one of them was a movie star, and that it was following his development as a star, and he had like this posse of guys, and they had the opening scene is the four of them getting out of a convertible and everybody opening a door, and the back doors, I think, opened.
Suicide.
Yeah, suicide-wise. So I'm trying to remember. I'll think some, that name of the show will come to me, but I believe that was the opening scene.
Our question number two is, where is your next road trip? Sorry, Don.
No, go ahead.
So yeah, we were actually just talking about this morning, oddly. And that road trip is probably, we've not been to like Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, that part of the world. And I think it's apropos that we go in a runaway go. I really do think that we take the runaway go and we go up there and do that road trip. So that would be our next road trip. Don't know when, given circumstances, but yeah. Certainly that would be on the list.
Excellent. Number three, question number three is, what's the most fascinating thing you've seen in someone's house or garage?
So the most, and I'll since this is a car show and a show about cars, I'll speak to a garage. So I was up in Chicagoland in the spring of 2019 at my cousin's place, and they have a nice big house, very, I guess, posh part of Chicago. They're both doctors. And so I walk into the garage, and so there's an assortment of very nice vehicles, and there is an Audi Roadster up on a jack, or on a, you know,
like a lift,
call that, but a lift. And so I was just so I was like, wow, this is how the other half lives. And again, my cousin brother-in-law is a very, very modest guy, very, very nice. And so, you know, I obviously you could see my eyes, you know, dilating and the like. And so when he went to drop me back off at the hotel later, you know, when we were leaving, he pulled it off the rack, and we hopped in the Audi Roadster, and he took me back. So that was a huge thrill. But just walking in on that was amazing. You know, just people actually do this. It's not like what you've got in the back, which is a full fledged garage, I presume. But this is in someone's house.
It's more common than you think, particularly in the car enthusiast crowd, because a good 4-post hydraulic lift actually starts under $5,000.
Hmm. So it's an easy way to store.
Yeah, as long as you've got the vertical clearance, that gets you two parking spaces in the footprint of one.
Yeah. So that's it.
Very cool.
All right. So I'm going to go back and say that the show was Entourage, and the boys would drive in a 1965 Lincoln Continental. It was black and it had the suicide doors in the back.
Although these days, if you find a good 4-door sedan, you could just shop it and not put up a convertible top, just leave it open. It's still technically an open drive convertible vehicle as long as you counter for the loss of structural integrity by removing the roof. Ben looks like he's very pensive on this topic.
Well, the whole term convertible means convert, to change, you know. So if you've chopped the top off, it's not a convertible, it's open.
Just open, right? So not every car is a potential convertible. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
So the things we could do with a Sawzall. All right, Art, my last question for you for today is, what is your biggest kitchen fail?
Kitchen fail? I had made, this is probably, gosh.
I drive all of mine out of
Mickey, when we lived in Kennesaw, I had made this bread with it was like a rolled bread, and I'd put I can't remember what I'd put into it. But when it baked, it had all collapsed. And so you just had like this, you know, hanger that was foodless. Just there was nothing there, and everything had kind of settled, and it had baked, but it just didn't have that, you know, that sponginess, that bread-like texture you wanted because everything had just collapsed. So, you know, I want to do that again. I feel like I've improved as a baker.
You want to do the same thing or something better?
Something different, but the same kind of approach to see if I can improve upon that. But it's like you cut into it and it just, it was like the, going back to Christmas Vacation, it was turkey. Like the turkey exploded. Yeah. And you're like, that's not what we were expecting to come from inside.
So bread. Did you make this from scratch? Did you use yeast, of course?
Yeah,
I think so. So two things I've done this. You either did not let the yeast rise enough and let the dough recycle and rise as you put the yeast in, or your yeast was bad.
It could have been either one of those.
Nothing worse than bad yeast.
Or both. Mm-hmm.
Here's a good reason to get that RV so you can try this again while you're on vacation.
Yeah.
That's right.
Because you'll have
plenty
of time. Exactly.
Remember to close the refrigerator door. Right. Yes.
Well, thank you, Arp. This is good stuff. We need to definitely have you back on the show and talk some more about, you know, just the pure zen of driving, I think, maybe the way to do it.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for Ben to take a moment. Ben, take us away.
Yeah, well, just to flash back there for a second, I'm also reminded of that Green Acres episode in which Lisa Douglas uses hotcake batter to make a cylinder head for the old Ford truck. But I'd like to take a moment today to talk about, of all things, convertibles. And yes, I did actually plan that ahead of time. Because it was a chilly morning today, and I went to a cruise inn and look at all these, you know, pretty cars, and a bunch of them there had the tops down despite the temperature being in the 30s when they got there. And, you know, I thought, you know, that's just a great kind of car. And if you've got the right spirit, it doesn't matter what the weather outside is. There's something about being able to change from sheltered to unsheltered. Of course, if you go back to the genesis of the automobile, they were all open initially. And I'm not sure when the term convertible came in, but the first ones were probably sold more on the ability to create shelter than to get away from shelter, as more and more people motored in bad weather and such. But, I'd never have owned one myself. My dad had several when I was a kid, and I'm thinking one of these days I really should. But
you should.
You should.
Yeah. And convertibles are the best.
I've had nothing but convertibles for the last 22 years.
Yeah, I remember this one time, and it was too cold to put the top down, really. But this one weekend when I was in the Army, I was the base I was at was about an hour and a half from where my dad lived. I woke up one Saturday morning to, you know, him knocking on the door of the upstairs bedroom I was sleeping in, and he comes in with some car keys. He goes, you know, hey, what do you think it might be fun if you took the Alpha over to Alabama to see your mom for the weekend? I can have you back to the base in time on Sunday night. The Alpha in question was a 1976 Spider that he had.
Wow.
And so I said, yeah, I think I was dressed and out the door inside of 20 minutes.
And you know what? Here's two tricks. So I have, as you all know, 2004 CLK 320. And you can literally, it doesn't matter how cold, if you put the top down, but leave all the windows up and put the windshield, the windscreen up in the back. Now, granted, one of my windows is not going up right now. We'll get there. But so you put the windscreen up, you turn on the accoutrements, heated seats, ARP, and you blast your heat. It doesn't matter how cold, you have a little bubble because the wind just goes over your windshield and you have a nice warm little bubble.
This does work better with, you know, good modern ones that have good aerodynamics. You know.
And, yes. And it also works when you have heated seats.
Yeah.
Thing that you said, any weather, I have actually proven this in Florida.
Fantastic.
If I have, again, all the windows up and it is raining out and I can get up to 65 miles an hour straight away, I will not get rained on. Yeah. I will not come in the car. You create this nice little stream and you are completely dry and it could be pouring down rain outside. So
I did the weather thing last year in January. I had one of my business trips was down to Florida, you know, and I've done several of these where I'll look at who I have to visit and, you know, try to structure the travel. And for some of these trips, what I'll do is I'll take a one-way flight to my farthest point and then drive back hitting the customers along the way. And I had one of these where I had to start in Miami. And then I had a customer in Orlando and then another one, you know, near the Florida, Georgia line somewhere. And it's January. I get to Miami. Of course, it's warm down there that time of year. But I get to the airport there, and I'm looking at the rental cars. And oh, my goodness, there's a convertible Mustang just waiting for me. So I grabbed it. And the whole way from Miami back to Atlanta, I had the top down except for about 20 minutes worth one morning when it was a little chilly. But, you know, daytime, nighttime, I had that sucker down. And the Mustang has not only the door windows, but it's got two little quarter windows mm-hmm. that come up as well. Mm-hmm. So with those up, and then you aim the vents a certain way, the weakness of this, and it had heated seats too, but the weakness of this is that there is a little eddy current that will come back right between the seats and hit you in the elbow with that particular car.
Oh, with that one. I was going to say, I've never had that problem.
Yeah. If you've got that rear shield in the Mercedes, then you're not going to have that. But
There was a time, my partner's on my first anniversary. We flew to Miami and I was like, man, this is almost 30 years ago now. And I had rented a convertible because rental companies had just started like putting convertibles widespread in the fleet. And we're going to rent a convertible at Miami Airport, and we're going to drive down to Key West for a long weekend. So get to the airport, go out to the lot, and I was given a convertible. It was a Geo Metro convertible with a three-cylinder engine. So all the way down Highway 1, you're like, you know, instead of the great roar of a convertible, it's going.
Yeah.
Were you pedaling?
Yeah, as soon as we got past Homestead, weather was nice. We dropped to the top. Both of us had our shirts off. Just worked our way down the highway to Key West. Neither of us thinking about the fact that we were wearing shoulder harnesses. And so arrived at this resort we're going to looking like we had been outside wearing bandoleros for, you know, 2 weeks.
Yeah, that's the beauty of a convertible is that there is also a lot of norms that you get used to. You know, you think, do I want a farmer's tan or not? Right. You have to think, I've already replaced the hydraulics on my convertible top because they wear out. They get sticky. You have to remember to put that thing up and down even in the winter, or by the first time you do it when the weather gets nice, it hates you and it fusses at you.
Yep.
There's a lot. So thanks for bringing this to us, Ben. Anytime anybody's welcome to come and take a ride with me.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and one of those little mannerism things too, you know, my dad, when I was a kid, he had a small fleet of Sunbeam Alpines and, you know, these were, you know, old school, you know, they didn't have the great aerodynamics of your drop tops of today. And so my father was not a hat person at all. He never, ever wore hats unless he was driving one of these Sunbeams. He kept one in the glove box to keep his hair from getting completely messed up. Because with those old school poor aerodynamics, the wind would come over the screen there, just curl back and batter the back of your head. And, you know.
So that's another thing. I keep a hair clip in my car, or I end up having a knotted mess wherever I go.
I don't have any of these problems being a completely bald individual, but I would keep a hat in the car just to avoid the third degree sunburn that I would inevitably get top of my poor head. Yes. So thank you, Ben. Anything else?
Oh, that's about it.
How about we do a quick moment of listener/viewer mail? I actually found a car question. And we briefly discussed this on our Think About Cars talk group on Facebook, our little chat element, where a friend of ours says that whenever she turns on her heater, she would smell something that smelled like horses coming out of her vents. And so I guided her through some of the other options we talked about and asked her some more questions. It turns out she only smells this horsey smell when she turns on the defroster, not the heater. Not just the heater, right? So she can turn on the heater and that smells fine. But whenever she turns on the defroster, this musty, horsey smell comes out of that. And she's trying to figure that out. So I did suggest spraying Lysol into the ventilation intakes and changing her cabin filter. But if none of the other ventilation options are producing a musty odor, it's probably not the cabin filter. So she's going to do the Lysol thing and get back to us. But I thought I'd throw that out there for general discussion now in case this revelation of it only happening when the defroster is on is relevant?
Oh, well, I think of something right away.
Yeah.
The defroster ducts are the only ones that point up, which means mm-hmm. things can fall in them.
Right.
Yeah, I'm thinking there might be mold in there, because if you think about it, that's where the condensation, and that's why we use defrosters anyway. So she may have mold growing.
That was my original thought.
Yeah.
Any number of possibilities there, yeah.
Right, which still takes us back to spraying some Lysol in the vent and having it run on defrost for a while, and maybe that will solve the problem. So I hope she does get to solve it. I want to share another worst car you ever owned story, since we have a little bit of time here. You guys might get a kick out of this one. My friend Marisa says she had a Renault Le Car that was gifted to my ex by his brother, and somehow Marisa is the one who ended up with it. She says it was hideously ugly and a total dog. Things that did not work included the heat, the radio, second gear. She had to roll it and pop the clutch to start it. Basically could not lock it because it had a cloth top, so you could just pop off and you could put your hand down a window and push in a little bit to get the window down. Also, it had no air conditioning, of course, and it rattled and was super top heavy around turns. It's true. I've actually seen a Renault Le Car tip over on what I thought was a no-brainer turn before. She says, I'm sure I've forgotten a few of its other faults. Also, when we got it back, the seat was completely full of garbage, mostly fast food refuse, and empty White Owl cigar boxes. I don't know if White Owl's a cigar thing or not. Anyway, she says, I won't talk about the lovely aroma. So Renault Le Car counts as Marisa's worst car she ever owned.
I've never heard anyone refer to the either the Renault Le Car or its sister, the Renault Alliance, or as we called it in college, the Renault Appliance, as their favorite car.
It's a workhorse starter car, and it's the fact that it's called Le Car.
I don't want to downplay anybody's appreciation of these things. If what you like is a Renault Le Car, more power to you.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some
skinny jeaned hipster somewhere in the United States who has one that he's very proud of and takes to cruise ins.
Right.
And should right. be. I mean, that should be a car, you know?
Well, to wrap it out, my friend Jennifer then wrote back to Marisa. She says, you just unlocked a memory for me. She says, I sort of learned to drive stick on a Le Car when I was around 13 on a farm. That car was Hunter Safety Orange, and we spray painted the outside with three shades of gray and brown to make it look camouflaged, but the interior remained that awful orange color. It was a fun little car for us as kids and teens, just to joyride through the country on the farm, or pretend to go hunting when we were really sneaking terrible beers and just generally goofing off. She says, what's funny is that her dad bought a pair of them so that he could take parts off of one to fix the other, but they were both so terrible, eventually he hauled both of them off to a scrap dealer and made a bit of his money back. So interesting stories from a couple friends about a Le Car.
If you want to see the opposite end of the spectrum, of course, they only called it Le Car in the United States. That was just their marketing gimmick over here. In Europe, it was the R5.
Right.
And basic wheels in France and Germany and places like that. The opposite end of the spectrum, there was a mid-engine turbo version that was made for homologation to qualify for Group B racing. So if you look up the R5 Turbo 2, that is really something.
Huh. Interesting.
And that I would have in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. And that wraps up our listener viewer mail segment. If any listener or any of our family of Thing About Cars friends has a story they want to share or a car question they want to ask, please contact us through our Facebook page. And that's the Thing About Cars. Just search for the Thing About Cars on Facebook groups and you'll find us. Let's switch gears back down to our grand trivia auto question before we exit out of the show. Ben, you want to wrap this one up for us?
Yeah. So let's see. Do I still have it? Yes, I do still have the page with the with the choices here. Good. Thought I'd close that. So the question was, where did the name of the Lincoln car brand come from? Was it A, Henry Leland chose this name to honor President Abraham Lincoln? B, British immigrant Richard Trevithick founded Lincoln Boiler Company in 1844, and in Old English, Lincoln means fresh water, blah, 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 eventually made cars. Or C, Lincoln is the name of the enormous palace in the center of Luxor, Egypt that the pharaohs had, which investors thought sounded cool.
Let's let Arp have our first guest here as our guest of honor.
I'm an Anglophile. I'm going to go with B.
B. All right. Don, what do you think?
I'm trying not to be a brainiac on this one. So, and I know a lot about Egypt. I'm going to go with the president, President Lincoln. Dave? Just going to call it.
Okay. Dave?
Let's see. Arp has gone for the British version. Don's gone for this. I'll go for Luxor.
And I know the answer because I saw the question come in. Ben, what's the answer?
The answer is A, the president.
Wow.
Hey, Don.
The other two just sound so far-fetched, and I am an Egypt amateur historian, so I was like, I've never heard of Lincoln.
It is an old English name, though, so there's a little plausibility to B.
Yeah, right. But C seemed really far-fetched.
Yeah, Lincoln Palace.
The funny one, there was a Lincoln Palace. It was an old bishop's palace in Lincolnshire in England. Yeah. So I'm like, okay. Just
not in Egypt, not shaped like, nothing shaped like a pyramid.
Nothing shaped like a pyramid.
So cool. All Thank right. you, Tim, for the excellent trivia question from our friend Tim. And that takes us to the end of this episode of The Thing About Cars. Anybody got any quick parting words for our family of friends?
Just ask everybody to give us reviews and rate us online.
Yeah.
That's right.
And ask others to join because we're getting a lot of folks saying you're very approachable and we want people to learn about cars and love cars like we do.
Yeah, and have as much fun as we do too. So please do, please leave your ratings. And if you have any questions, like I said, just contact us via our Facebook page or our website. That's thethingaboutcars.com. In the meantime, we hope you and yours are staying safe out there. We will see you with another episode in about a week. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.